Dr. Nick Morgan, thanks for joining me today. Wonderful to have you here.
Art, it's good as always to see you again.
I have to tell you, if I'm a little bit giddy over the opportunity to connect with you, not only from a friendship standpoint, but one of the world's leading authorities on developing as a speaker, on communications, and so many other issues. Well, if I'm a little bit giddy, it's because I am. So again, thanks for being here. I've got an audience that's just hungry for tips and ideas and approaches on succeeding as communicators in the workplace. Typically, my audience are individuals who are climbing the ladder or climbing sideways, broadening their experiences. They want to do a better job, motivating, leading, persuading, navigating challenging conversations, and certainly and opportunities to speak. So. This is just a great chance for them. Thank you.
We used to call that climbing the greasy pole. Is that still what it's called? With the implication being, if you're not good at it, you can slide back down. So
I haven't heard that term, but I like it a lot. You may see them show up on a blog post with attribution, of course.
Yeah. Let the tips begin. We don't want anybody sliding back down that.
That's right. So you've been busy the last few years, from Power Cues, which is what, 3 or 4 years now. And then Can You Hear Me Now? How to Connect with People in a Virtual World. It's been a busy couple of years for book publishing for you. And it seems like those two do a wonderful job interconnecting, because one focuses on all of those issues that we can deal with when we're communicating face-to-face, and the other one says, forget all of that. It doesn't really apply in a world where we're not seeing each other right now. So brilliant marketing, by the way.
No, thanks. Yes. So true. In fact, Can You Hear Me came out of discussions when I was talking about Power Cues, because I started to get that question from the audience. And it was almost always the first question when the Q&A started. Was, oh, come on. So this body language stuff is great. It's a lot of fun. But frankly, I hardly ever see my team anymore. It's a virtual team. And that experience got repeated over and over again. And I thought, I better start writing something about that. I better find out more about it. So,
I navigate this all the time with clients. I run a little very real world case of a client of mine named Raj. He gave me permission to use his name. And I think at the point in time, he had a virtual team around the world on 3 different continents. I have no idea how many time zones, and that virtual team of a dozen people or so, only 2 reported directly to him. The rest, cultural differences, language differences, time zone differences, and he would almost never see them. And I mean, what a challenge that is. And that's just becoming commonplace for all of us.
Yeah, exactly. We all seem to be dealing with that. And the fascinating thing about that for me is, just from the word go, even assuming you can communicate interculturally and those issues don't come up, which of course they do. Right. But the first thing you have to realize in that situation is that everybody's in a different time zone. And that means they're at a different biorhythm, or whatever you want to call it, in their day. So some people are starting out fresh. Other people have had a long day and they're exhausted. Some people are in the middle of their day. And can you imagine having a face-to-face meeting where everybody shows up with those kind of different levels of energy? It would be very strange. And so that's just the first hurdle in the virtual world.
No doubt about it. Hey, so before we dive into some of the content, I would love if you would be comfortable sharing one of those horrifying stories from your earlier life that you describe in, that you love the way I set that up. Yeah. And this is the toboggan incident.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I was thinking about that the other day for reasons which we can get into. So I was 17 and tobogganing with a couple of friends. We hurtled down the hill the first time and made it and to the bottom successfully. And so, being a brash 17-year-old, I said, we didn't go fast enough. So they said, why don't you take the run on your own if you're so cool? So I did, and didn't make it, and fractured my skull. I'm laughing now, but at the time I was in a coma, and I actually died technically for 15 minutes. I'm only here on the planet thanks to a very gifted neurosurgeon who managed to save my life and my head, even more importantly. But they give you a test when you wake up from one of those horrific incidences. And it's a simple IQ test, not a very not a very exact one, but just enough to see whether the accident has rendered you mute or not. And I passed that test, but there was a deeper problem that I wasn't tested for. I didn't know how to articulate, that doctors didn't ask me about. Mm-hmm. And that was that when I went back to school, I was in high school. When I went back to school, I found I couldn't read the unconscious behavior of my friends, and which we all can do, by the way. This is not a secret trick I'd had before. We all have this ability. We all can walk into a room, especially with people we know well, and we can tell if they're angry or happy or sad, especially if it's a strong emotion. It's just we get used to their signs, and we can read that. Well, suddenly I couldn't read that. Now imagine a 17-year-old unable to read the signs, say, of sarcasm. Everything 17-year-olds say to each other is sarcastic. So,
sarcastic, right.
And so the first 10 things I think somebody said to me was, Nick, you look great. And of course, I looked horrible. I was pale from 6 weeks in the hospital. I had this terrific scar running down the side of my head. I was still wearing bandages, and I was sort of walking like a zombie. I did not look good. And so when they said, you look great, I said, oh, thanks. Unable to pick up on the heavy sarcasm.
Did they look at you sideways?
They sure did. And they said, being friends, they said, Nick, we didn't mean that. You actually look terrible. What's up with you? What's the matter with you? And it was only slowly that I discovered this huge lack in me, the inability to get that connection. And so I started teaching myself very slowly and painfully by watching people to the point of making them nervous, watching people and just trying to figure out what their behavior meant. And more formally, what I was trying to figure out, and this is where your listeners should pay attention, close attention, what I was trying to figure out was the intent behind their body language. Mm-hmm. And I say that because that's what people care about. We humans care more than anything else when we're communicating with somebody else. What we care about is your intent toward me, my intent toward you. We want our intent toward you usually to be understood and heard and respected. Occasionally we want to conceal our intent if we have some other design for you. We're trying to trick you into a negotiation, say, or if we're trying to veil hostile intent or something. But on the whole, we want to be heard and understood, and we certainly want to know what the other person's intent is toward us. That's very important to us. And in fact, it's the first fundamental question we humans ask of each other, which is friend or foe.
Sure.
That's a question of intent. And that's read in the body language. And the reason, by the way, it's read in the body language is that body language is faster than your mind, your conscious mind, can calculate. So if I had to stop and study you, Art, and say, Art's twitching in this way, or he's got his eyes focused this way, or he's got this attitude on his face, what does that mean? That means he's a friend. Okay, I can relax. If I had to do all that, if you were a foe, you would have killed me by then. So we've evolved to be very, very quick at reading the friend or foe question unconsciously. And that's what I couldn't do as a teen and had to relearn.
I mean, that had to be horrifying to figure out that switch had been flipped off. You know,
it was very strange. Felt like I describe it as before that, I'd been in a color movie, like most of us are.
Right.
And while that period of time, that relearning was going on, which was about a year, it was like being in a black and white movie. I was, compared to color, I was just less attuned to the world, pretty clueless, often sort of spaced out and couldn't figure out what was going on around me. And it was a very disorienting feeling.
I have to imagine that it played a formative role in your ultimate direction in life and many of the things that you do and your interest in power cues and nonverbal communication and what have you. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I didn't realize it at the time, but that started the lifelong interest in body language, of course, especially, but communications in general. And then in the long run, and what came out in power cues was this idea, because I had to learn it consciously, I formed this idea that you could communicate with intent as opposed to leaving it to chance. Now, let me just unpack that for a second. So your listeners, when they're getting ready to give an important presentation or go into negotiation and whatnot, you all will think about what you're going to say. You'll think about the content. You may do a PowerPoint deck to prepare. Whatever your poison of choice is, you'll think hard about the content.
Right.
When I ask audiences, how many of you prepare your body language in advance? If they're being honest, 100% of them say, the amount of time I spend thinking about the body language is 0%. The amount of time thinking about the content is 100%. And I'll say, why is that? Because body language is as important as content in communication. So why wouldn't you prepare that as well? And it's very interesting as people talk about that, there's this sense that that feels kind of manipulative or a strange thing to do. They just don't think of it that way. They think of their emotions as guiding their intent, and that should just sort of happen naturally. Mm-hmm. But then when they stop and think about it, they say, well, of course, sure, I'd want to plan that just as much as I plan content. So once you've had that conversation, once you've thought that to yourself, then it sort of changes your outlook. And you think, I want to communicate with intent. Just as I wouldn't go to work dressed in pajamas, I wouldn't go to work just broadcasting a random intent if I thought about it beforehand.
So one of the examples you describe in Power Cues I found fascinating. You were working with a group and you had them all introduce themselves. And they didn't really know that you were going to kind of monitor or observe. And one individual in particular gave a very kind of closed, careful, shy, you know, maybe frightened introduction, and you coached him and he went through it the second time. Share what happened there. It was fascinating.
Yeah, so the instruction was just introduce yourself in 1 minute. Take 60 seconds.
Right.
And this gentleman had been in the war in Iraq, and he had come back and he was dedicating his life to public service after that experience. And it had been particularly troubling for him in various ways we didn't go into, but he was presented as somebody who was holding something in. He was very buttoned down, and meeting him initially in social circumstances, you might not have been able to pick up whether he was actually holding something horrific back or whether he was just kind of buttoned down, but he didn't let much out. And that showed up in his body language. His body language is very closed. So when we say body language is closed, we mean that, especially with your hands are kept in front of your torso in a protective way, one way or another. His hands were all here in front of his torso. And so I drew him aside, and the simple coaching I gave to him was, I said, all right, now I want you to go out and give exactly the same speech, word for word, if you can. And you'll see why I said that in a second. And I said, but you're going to park your hands out here somewhere and just leave them there. So he thought that was strange, but he was willing to try. He's a good guy. And so he did. He went out and talked to the same 60 people roughly in the audience, and he held his hands there the whole time. And what came out was completely different.
Wow.
He suddenly started sharing, even though he'd been instructed to give exactly the same talk, he suddenly started sharing these horrific things that had happened to him in Iraq, and that was why he had decided to dedicate his life to helping children at risk and in need. And by the time he was done, he spoke for about 5 minutes, but nobody wanted him to stop. And by the time he was done, half the audience was crying. He was close to tears himself. It was a very moving, it was an extraordinary thing. And when I asked the audience, so what was different? They said, well, you know, a completely different person showed up. Nobody said, well, he held his hands out here.
Right.
And the reason for that is we don't consciously read body language, because we care about the intent behind the body language. And so what they saw was an open person. And what he saw, interestingly enough, was an open person. And so he became more open. He was able to share. And he was as astonished by the experience as the audience.
It's just a brilliant example. And it really underscores so much of what you teach in Power Cues. You know what? I have to tell you, there's a personal two personal tie-ins here. One is that while we were doing some work together, you noticed very quickly that I had this habit of clenching my fists.
Mm.
And you asked me at one point in time, who are you preparing to fight? And I never thought about it. So to this day, I continue in all of the video elements that I work on. I'm doing a lot of video courses to watch it. And every once in a while, I still catch myself and I just cringe and I feel the wrath of Nick coming down.
It's funny. I was working with somebody just the other day and they were, I was working on opening up their body language. It had been quite closed. And a different issue than our Iraq vet, but nonetheless, it was still also about opening up the body language. A very simple sort of first step. But what she was doing was interesting. As she was being conscious about her body language, she held her hands rigidly like this.
Right.
And so they weren't clenched. They weren't in fists, but they were very rigid. And it was as if she was saying to herself, my God, I'm holding my hands out here. I'm suddenly very aware of them.
What are these things?
Yes. And she had large hands. And it turned out she was self-conscious about those large hands. Okay. So it was this sort of bringing up this old feeling. And so I gave her the tip. And for those of you in your audience who are old enough to remember Fred Astaire, it may interest you to know Fred Astaire also was incredibly self-conscious about his hands. He felt, rightly or wrongly, he felt he had large hands. And he thought as a dancer that would be a terrible problem in sort of distract people from the elegance of his dancing. He didn't want them looking at his hands. So somebody gave him the trick of if you hold the middle two fingers in like this, mm-hmm. it will make your hands look smaller. Now, I can't really pass judgment on the truth of that, whether that actually makes your hands look smaller or not. But the point is, Fred Astaire was convinced that they did. Uh-huh. And so just for fun, a little assignment for any member in your audience, rent or stream an old Fred Astaire movie and look at those hands. And you'll see as he dances, and this is only while he's dancing, but he's always got his hands like this in order to make those hands look smaller.
Absolutely fascinating. Never knew that. So, and by the by, as a result of this little segment, we're now going to have 10 or 15,000 people suddenly conscious of their hands when they're talking.
That's right. Sorry, folks.
Yeah. All right. So before we dive a little bit into some of the details of power cues and can you hear me, I have a question. This is another example from my background. Earlier in my career, I worked in an industry and there was one gentleman, his name was Clarence. Clarence was kind of the patriarch of the industry. He didn't work for the vendors, he had his own business, but when Clarence showed up, something interesting happened. And I've only thought about it in hindsight. Clarence actually would never show up at, for example, a conference at the beginning of the conference. He would show up at lunch of the first day. Mm-hmm. And when Clarence walked into a room, the only way I can describe it is that this sudden warmth enveloped the room. Hmm. And there was an attitude that Clarence exuded, not of I'm here, but of you're here.
Wow.
And he would proceed to go around and introduce or say hello and shake hands and connect with every single person in the room. Didn't matter whether they were the top executive or, you know, me and my little role as a peon over here. Hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, you treat us with a regard and a respect and make that eye contact and smile. But that warmth, and I've observed him over a decade or so, he just had the ability to walk into a room and light it up. What yeah. was he doing? Because I want some of that. And I think a lot of my listeners and viewers want that.
Yeah, that's a wonderful example. And good for you for spotting it. It's something that all your viewers, listeners can do. And it's, we call it charisma,
right.
for lack of a better word. We think of it as something that's sort of magic fairy dust that's sprinkled on people, some people and not other people. And so we think they're special as a result. And they are they are special. They're doing something sure. that most people don't do. But the point is, you can do it too. It's not magic. And it's actually quite simple to describe. It's just difficult to get the hang of. It takes mm-hmm. some practice. And what Clarence is doing in that situation is he's focusing. So most of us walk around with a to-do list in our head.
Right.
And we're thinking about what we have to do before the day is over, otherwise we'll be in trouble. We think about lunch. We think about our vacation coming up. We think about everything on our to-do list.
Sure.
And so when we walk into a room, we're telegraphing that sense of not being fully there, of having a lot in our minds. And that shows up in various subtle ways in body language. One of the ways it shows up, by the way, which has been made worse by these things, mobile phones, is that we all tend now to pitch our head forwards a little bit.
Ah,
when your head is forward, to the rest of the people around you, it looks like you're withdrawing from the world. And so you're not fully focused and present. So that's the first tip is get your head up and make eye contact with people. But more important than that is the focus. And it's not just focusing by excluding your to-do list. It's focusing on a strong emotion. What Clarence is doing is focusing on love or warmth or something that allowed him to radiate a lot of warmth toward these people and want to connect with them. And he may have been remembering, a moment in mm-hmm. his life when he felt that, and he uses that to get himself, it may be get himself focused. It may be unconscious on his part. He may just do it because he's found that's a wonderful thing for him, a good way for him to walk into a room. I don't know. I can't comment on whether it's sure. conscious or unconscious, but the point is that he does it, and all your audience can do it too. As I say, simple to describe. All you have to do is focus. Exclude your to-do list. Focus on the moment. Gen up, create a strong emotion, and let the rest happen. Now, as I say, that's easier said than done.
Right.
That's the hard part. Most people who can crank up strong emotions on demand are in Hollywood right now, earning $35 million a picture, and the rest of us are doing other jobs because we're doing this because we find that harder to do. So, so I'm not saying it's easy to do.
Sure. But that, sure.
It's simple to describe. It's emotional focus.
So in reading Power Cues, I wondered with Clarence's approach, how he managed to blend that with projecting power. Because, you know, you had the impression that he was the most powerful person suddenly in the room, yeah. even though there was that warmth. It wasn't that frightening, scary, command and control type of power.
Yeah, so power, commanding control power, by the way, is making eye contact, but then you tip your head forward just slightly. It's that's a more detailed thing. Don't try that at home because it takes more description. But the way in which you show up with authority or power, as you say, non-scary power, but just draw all eyes to you power, is again very simple to describe but hard to do. And that is you inhabit your full height.
Mm-hmm.
And so as we're standing, I'm standing here, you're sitting, I notice as I'm standing here, I'm relaxed, chatting mm-hmm. with an old friend. So I'm a little slouched. I'm not standing as straight as Nick Morgan should or could if grandma was watching and telling me, posture, Nicholas. And so if I stand up straight like that and inhabit my full height, and I walk into a room doing that, and there are a few other little things you need to do, but that's where it starts. Then I will command more respect in the room. And I will tell you that the most powerful person in that sense that I ever met was at a cocktail party a number of years ago when I was still involved in politics, was the wife of President Johnson, so Lady Bird Johnson.
Right.
Now, Lady Bird, for those of you who have never met her, is about 4'8". She is tiny. And yet when she walked into the room, everybody reoriented toward her.
Mm-hmm.
No words were spoken. It's just, we all knew when she walked into the room, all our heads swiveled, our eyes went over to her because she walked in with that incredible presence. And that began with, she was inhabiting every single millimeter of that 4'8" height. So that's where it starts.
Fascinating. So as we dig into power cues a little bit, the kind of the theme that resonates, and I think your words were, we're all having two conversations.
Yeah, that's right.
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so every communication is two conversations. always. Yeah. It's the content on the one hand, it's what you're saying, and it's the body language, how you're saying it.
Right.
Now, the key to that is when those two are aligned, they're not the same conversation exactly, because the body language conversation is much dumber and simpler, but it's more powerful than the content conversation. Mm-hmm. And so when the two are aligned, so you and I are having a conversation, we're catching up on news about each other before this mm-hmm. video started. If I was sending out faux signals, in other words, if I was pretending to be nice, but sending out friend or faux signals, then that would override any content that I was saying. And at the end of that conversation, you would not recall the content of what we had exchanged, merely my intent, my evil intent. And so the two conversations have to align for us to be able to absorb each other's content. In other words, I have to feel relaxed enough and aligned enough that you and I can have a conversation. So the body language conversation enables mm-hmm. the content conversation. Now, when they're not aligned, what happens is the body language always wins. And to give a very simple example, most of your audience will have a significant other, a spouse or a partner. If you go home and your partner's got his or her arms folded and he or she has a scowl on his or her face, and you say, "How are you?" the automatic spousal question, then the spousal answer, and I've asked audiences this many times and everybody says the same thing, is fine. That's what people say when you ask them how they are and they're angry. But the body language, which you pick up on immediately because you know the other person well, says something different. Now, my question is simple. Which do you believe?
Yeah, all body language all day long.
I'm
and I'm going into defend mode instantaneously.
Yeah, instantaneously. Yeah, you got it. So
the amygdala was kicked in. I'm flooded with adrenaline and cortisol, and
It's not good. Yeah. So the word "fine" is the content there, but nobody believes it. Immediately, it's trumped by the body language. So that's a very simple example.
Sure.
Lets you see what's going on. So that's the two conversations, and that's why we need to work so hard to make sure when we're in an important situation like a presentation or negotiation that our body language is aligned with our content, supports it. It's not, again, it's not the same conversation. You can't say in body language, third quarter earnings are going to be 10% more than they were in second quarter. But you can say, I'm confident, I feel strongly about these results, I believe in them, they're exciting, that's cool, let's go. And then people will hear that good news
or you can deliver the disappointing news if earnings aren't where they need to be, but still with confidence and perhaps hedge that that situation a little bit.
That's right. Although you don't want to do the classic mistake of delivering terrible news with a big smile on your face, because then you look psycho. But yeah, so that's why you need to
think about. Note to everybody out there: do not look psycho. Okay.
but that's exactly the point. The two conversations are different, but the one can support the other, and you need to think that through. That's why I say you want to communicate with intent. You want to decide in advance what it is. What do I want to bring to the table here? Otherwise, you risk undercutting yourself for precisely the kind of reasons we're alluding to.
So I worked with a great young professional. She actually taught me a valuable lesson. I had been working with this client, and it was a multi-day workshop program, and I would pull into the parking lot every morning at headquarters, and I noticed a couple of mornings that I would see her sitting in her car, effectively doing nothing. Hmm. So I finally asked her at one of the breaks on about the third day, what are you doing there? And she goes, oh, I'm preparing my attitude. It's like, oh, that sounds cool. Tell me about that. Hmm. So she would literally spend time to clear her mind of all of the issues, distractions, headaches, the dog ate the kids' homework, she got a traffic ticket on the way, whatever it happened to be that particular day. And she would focus on how to be successful at every encounter. What I've never thought about until now is that my suspicion was that she also figured out, you know, maybe almost subconsciously, how to make sure her body language matched this great attitude that she wanted to carry into the day.
Yeah, the great thing, that's a wonderful example. I love that because I coach people to do that when they have an important meeting, to take a couple of minutes beforehand to clear the to-do list and to get ready and decide the emotion. But I love doing that every single day. What a great discipline. And I bet she's really effective in that that day then in what she's trying to do. It gets better.
She was priceless. At the end of the day, she reviews what happened. And, you know, most people would think about all the stuff they didn't get to, all the things they didn't cross off their list or nothing, you know, things that didn't work right. Mm. She simply focused on what worked great she would do more of tomorrow. And then she went home and repeated it. Oh, my gosh, do I love that cycle.
Wow, that's such a great way to do it because you're so right. We tend to obsess about what's remaining on our to-do list, the things we didn't get to and whatnot, and that drags us down. By the end of the day, we're exactly. We're drooping, and whereas she's pumped up by the day. What a great example.
So help us all understand a little bit more about this concept of the discrete power cues. And I know that, you know, we need to get the book in order to understand all of them, but maybe kind of the essence of what power cues are and how we can better tune into them.
Yes, the idea is that right from the moment that you meet somebody or you walk into a room, because of this second conversation that we're talking about, you are cueing everybody around you as to how you present in that room, where you are in the hierarchy in the organization, to repeat some of the examples we talked about, whether you're powerful or charismatic or whether you're invisible and not showing up with any authority. And that comes down to very basic things that begin with, first of all, how you feel about yourself, because body language is two things, and this is another important concept to get. It's always how you're feeling in the moment. So we've talked about that. It's about clearing the to-do list and whatnot. But it's also your history. Mm-hmm. And so by the time we're adults, we've had a number of life experiences, some good, some bad, hopefully. Hopefully more good than bad. But all of that shows up then in your body. How you feel about your body, whether you feel confident or not. We're now more open these days about various kinds of shaming that goes on in school, and kids often learn to be ashamed of their bodies in one way or another. Mm-hmm. Well, if they are, by the time they're grown-ups, that's going to show up in the way they hold themselves. And that's very much going to hold them back if there's some guilt or shame or feeling of inadequacy in the way they present themselves. And so the first power cue is really about taking stock of your own body language and your own history and saying, what is it in that's serving me and what is it that's not serving me?
And, is that kind of an extension of emotional intelligence, or am I reading that wrong?
No, I think it is. I think it's part of emotional intelligence. Sure. Okay. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I worked with an executive who had been promoted for 25 years in this one company because he was good in a crisis. And then he finally got his dream job, senior vice president. And he called me up. I got to know him 6 months into that job. He was about to be fired. Right. And I said, what's up? And he said, well, they tell me that all that being cool in a crisis means I squelch my emotions. And now as a senior vice president, I have to motivate people. They want me to show my emotions. And he was sort of laughing, but he was deadly serious. He said, can you help me learn how to show my employees I care, because I'm so used to being cool in a crisis, holding back my emotions, that everybody thinks I don't care. Huh. And when he showed up in my office, we have one of these big conference rooms with the long wooden table, the brown table like everybody else has. And everybody I work with goes and sits in the middle because they've learned that's the power position, or somebody's told them that's the power position. Right. Typically with their back to the wall and their face to the door. That's the way the powerful person sits.
Right.
He went and sat in the far corner with his back to the door. It was an extraordinary thing. Nobody had ever done that before. And as I was talking to him, his shoulders were rounded and his face was down. I couldn't make eye contact with him. And finally, after about an hour of chatting and me sort of going like this to try to get him to look at me, I called him on it. I said, hang on a minute. You say you want to be this SVP. You don't want to lose the job. It's important to you. It's your dream job. And yet you're behaving as if you wish to be invisible. What's up with that? And to my astonishment, he starts crying. Oh. And he says, I'm condensing now. It took a while to get the story out, but he revealed that he had been bullied from age 12 to age 18. And he had learned, and he figured this out, he had learned to be as inconspicuous as possible, to hold in his emotions, to be invisible, in fact, in order to avoid as much bullying as possible. And what he didn't realize was 30 years later, as an SVP, he was still carrying that invisibility wish, and it was showing up in his body language. And so he had to learn how not to do that. And the first thing I had him do was, I said, from now on, you're going to sit up straight like you're, like my grandmother taught me, and probably some authority figure told you. And so I called him 2 weeks later on a scheduled call to say, how's it going? And he says, you bastard. I said, what? He said, I'm in pain. I said, what do you mean? He said, I'm using muscles I haven't used for 30, 35 years. I'm sitting up straight. He said, it hurts. But your listeners will and viewers will be relieved to learn that he was able to change, and just it was more than just that one simple sitting up straight, but that was a huge first step. And what was fascinating was people started saying to him, there's something different about you. What's different?
Yeah,
and they couldn't put their finger on it, because again, we don't consciously think about body language, but they knew something had changed.
So how do people out there who are suddenly, you know, aware that, hey, maybe I'm not projecting what I want to project or what have you, how do they tune into this? I mean, you know, it's hard to recognize that in yourself.
It is. I recommend when I work with audiences, I always have them do this. I'm pairing up with somebody, a good friend, somebody you trust, because you want to be comfortable. But then sit across from them and be relaxed, be yourself. Don't suddenly do something different to try to show up in a certain way. Just have a conversation with them, and then pause at a certain point and say, now, can you give me honest feedback about what do you see here? Now, the other person, because they're not body language experts, won't be very good at saying, well, I see your shoulders are slumped or your head's held in this way. That's not the point. The point is they'll give you, if they're honest, they'll give you some feedback about how you're showing up as a human being. Yeah, you're a confident guy, or you always strike me as a little guarded, or it seems like you got something else in your mind. That's the kind of feedback you want. And so it takes a trusted friend to do that, but you can read between the lines typically. So the first thing to do is to start to get a little outside feedback.
Sure.
And then think about how does that resonate with how I feel about myself? And is there anywhere physically where that shows up? So a great example is, by the end of the day, most people, unlike the woman who you gave me the lovely example of, who focuses in the morning and again in the evening, most of us, by the end of the day, we're feeling it in our bodies, a typical hard day's work, right? And I often ask people, where does the tension show up? For a lot of people, it's right there.
Right here.
For some people, it's in their gut. For some people, it's lower back, if they've got lower back issues. And so that's an interesting place to start. That's usually a sign that the way you're holding yourself in that place is suboptimal, because if you're holding yourself in a way that's perfectly balanced and perfectly aligned, then you shouldn't be getting those kind of chronic aches and pains. And I'll fess up, for me, by the end of the day, it's and you gestured to the same place.
Absolutely. It's the acceptable
back of the neck. And so that comes from the kind of hunching and the tension there that we unconsciously carry through the day. And so often stretching or doing a bit of yoga or something like that will relieve that, but it's also about becoming more conscious of it.
Sure, fascinating. So one of the areas that so many of my clients deal with, and it's something that we strive to help them with in the different programs we offer, are navigating and succeeding, heck, surviving challenging conversations. So whether that's the, you know, seemingly or suddenly tense feedback discussion, or the one that I hear about a lot in some pretty competitive environments is almost, I know it's a strong term, but almost an attack by a coworker on the idea or the person. You know, it might go to the effect of, okay, well, you know, I have one example. Amy's giving a presentation to top executives, and one of the senior engineering managers raises his hand and said, Amy, why is this going to be any different than the disastrous project you led last year?
Ooh.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. You know,
and so the reaction at that point is the traditional fight or flight type scenario. You know, I would resort to the fight. Not a great habit, by the way, as you climb. And Amy, her tendency was to go to flight. How can we use power cues and mirroring and some of these great concepts to win the moment?
It's a great question, and it really is the essence of showing up with intent and then starting to use that to succeed in a difficult business environment. In that particular case, when somebody attacks you, you want to do the things that go against your instinct. So if your instinct is to freeze, as you said, Amy's is, typically what we do when somebody says something we don't like is we pull back.
Right.
And that's the first step in a kind of negative series of responses. But that pullback is very hard to fight against. It goes very deep with us. It's a reaction against anticipated violence, but also even things like bad smells or bad tastes.
Right.
It's just and it's designed to keep us alive. We just pull away from whatever that threat, perceived threat is. Well, you have to do the opposite. The way Amy could have won that situation was she could have walked over to Engineer Bob, let's call him, maybe even put her hand on his shoulder if she's standing up and he's sitting down, opened herself up and said, Bob, you know, you never felt that project went well. Let's talk about what in your mind were the things that went wrong. And then she's got prepared some responses for that. But the idea is to go open in that situation, look confident, and then that becomes an objection that you deal with, but you live through it and you go out the other side. Whereas if you go into fight or flight mode, the best you can do, the best you can hope for at that point is a truce. And of course, that's a nail in your coffin to get anything from the executive team.
All right, so let's peel, if you'll work with me on this one. We're going for some free consulting for the audience here. Let's freeze frame between that obnoxious comment and her walking over and opening and addressing Engineer Bob in this case. What should be going on in her mind right then?
So hopefully, we hope, she's anticipated that because she knows Bob, Engineer Bob, and she knows Bob's going to attack her. So hopefully you've given some thought to the way things that could go wrong. This is something that we're seeing now in the presidential debates as they're starting to gear up,
right.
Particularly those of you who saw the Democratic ones. In the second debate, you saw Kamala Harris attack Vice President Biden, and his response was very flat-footed. He clearly had not anticipated that attack. He wasn't ready for it. He waffled in his response. It was a bad moment for him. Mm-hmm. Had he had a response ready, and had he opened up and looked confident and said, like famously President Reagan did years ago, there you go again, you know, or his other wonderful one, which was the age question. He said, I won't use my my opponent's youth and inexperience against him. I mean, it's just, we can't always come up with those kind of brilliant lines that instantly diffuse the situation. But it was the confidence and optimism with which President Reagan delivered those comebacks, in addition to the words he said, that really carried the day. Mm-hmm. And it was his... so he's prepared for that. He knows his opponent's going to attack him. And he's saying to himself, I'm going to meet any attack with confidence.
Right.
And with, in his case, with a smile, with a laugh, which is just brilliantly dismissive. Mm-hmm. So we don't know if Amy could pull that off in that situation. Depends on the scenario. But even replying and responding with confidence and openness is a way to show I am master of the situation.
Right.
Your arrows are bouncing off me harmlessly.
I mean, well said. So it seems like those moments where we're challenged in communication settings are opportunities to really stand out, differentiate ourselves, show everyone that we're leaders. So isn't everybody in the room, and it was a group session at that point in time, aren't they watching, waiting for the reaction, and won't they potentially mirror whatever her reaction is?
Absolutely. And the interesting thing in that situation, now there may be political machinations going on and Bob may have allies and they may be trying to get their project put forward and hers not funded or something, who knows. But on the whole, if it's not all politically hardwired beforehand, on the whole, what you find is that people want the the speaker, the person in the hot seat to succeed. They're on your side, and it takes a lot to get them not on your side, and they tend to sympathize. We don't like it when somebody attacks somebody like that in that kind of situation. Again, unless you're hardwired to be a Bob supporter in the scenario we're describing, we're going to be on Amy's side. And so she doesn't even have to handle it brilliantly. If she handles it at all with a little bit of confidence and openness, chances are she's going to have the audience with her.
I suspect she follows you because she used your advice to a T, and she did something counterintuitive, as you suggested. She actually complimented him.
Brilliant. Yeah.
Bob, I'm really grateful that you raised that. When that we went through that disaster, your team was instrumental in helping us recover. And mine for lessons so that we don't make that again. We've come a long way since you helped us learn that experience. You know, as soon as she was done with that, she described it to me as that the entire room, you could hear the sigh of relief. And the CEO immediately jumped in and said, yeah, Bob, it's time to let that one go. You know, we're moving forward. So she won the moment there. And
brilliant. All right. Yeah. She, hats off to her. Yeah.
The other thing that she did, and I know it goes to one of your power cues, is when she debriefed with me, she told me that she had kind of sensed that Bob, in this case, she could read as he was doing this, that his head was down, and she expected something. So isn't that early warning system important for us to be
very
able
much,
to-
very much so. And that's another power cue, which is to start becoming more aware of the other people in the room, especially in important settings like that, where you need to know if you've got any enemies out there, that kind of thing. But you can very quickly learn to read body language of other people. And the way to do it is not to look for specific behavior. There's a lot of misinformation out there. I mean, the crossed arms, that's a pretty good sign. But you have to understand with body language, it's always, to use a mouthful phrase, multi-determined. In other words, he could also just be cold.
Right.
If it's a chilly room, maybe, or maybe he's got a bad back and this makes him feel more comfortable.
Right. We can't understand his intent. Can't crawl into his mind, but.
Right. And until we get enough evidence and we know, we've seen enough of him, his behavior, to know whether this is the norm, whether this is an aberration, what's going on. So we need to establish a baseline understanding. And so the TV shows that have body language experts reading strangers with unerring accuracy, I'm afraid that's BS. I'm sorry, it doesn't work that way. But you can get good at reading people that you know well because you know their baseline of behavior. And so you know when they're doing something that's out of the ordinary, or you know if they're just being their typical hostile self. Right. And so what you want to do is ask yourself a question. This is the way to think about body language is are the people in the room on my side for me or against me? Mm-hmm. Now, if you put that question in your mind, then you're going to start, your mind will be directed unconsciously as well as consciously toward picking up on the cues of people, positive or negative to what you're saying. And the reason you need to ask the question to yourself is that you need to focus on that because body language is, again, multi-determined. But people are sending out all kinds of cues all the time about how they're feeling. They're talking to a friend. They're looking out the window. They're momentarily distracted. There's way too much body language information coming at you. And so you need to focus on one issue. So think about what's the important issue I want to get out of this. And in that Amy's case, if it was a question of being funded, maybe or being her project being approved, then that was the question she had in mind: these people for me or against me?
Right.
Am I going to get approval or not? So she can ask that single question, and then her minds are incredible. They'll start to troll. Troll's not a good word here. To scan for that. That particular set of information, and so you'll learn to pick it up. It takes a little practice, but the more you practice, the better you'll get at it. A simple thing to do to practice, by the way, is to ask yourself the question when you're meeting somebody, ask it consciously, is this person a friend or a foe? Mm-hmm. And then you'll immediately start to close in on and focus in on the behavior, the friendly or unfriendly behavior, and you'll start to get better and better at that. So it just takes, again, a little practice.
You know, this whole, all of this content, the content and the ideas in Power Cues, fascinating. I'm a believer that what you're teaching and sharing through that is some of the most important material that those that are trying to climb the ladder, succeed, grow their influence, or in your vernacular, avoid sliding down the greasy pole, really need to understand and work on deliberately. So it's just fabulous stuff. I know we're running a little short on time. I could talk with you all day about this.
Yeah, we could go forever, Art. But yeah. any last question or two that you're desperate to
your
listeners?
Let's shift to for our last question or two to the world of the virtual communications.
Yeah.
Most of my clients complain about webinars and delivering webinars. And particularly in those environments when there is no visual, where they're not using the personal view. And I know I struggle with this. I'd rather get up in front of 500 people than deliver to a group of people where I'm talking to effectively nothing.
Right.
How do we get better at that?
Yeah, I say in the book, Can You Hear Me? First of all, we shouldn't do webinars. They're an evil form of human communication. They should just be eliminated from the world. And of course, I recognize I've lost that battle, right?
Yeah, you're not going to win that one.
I'm not going to win that one. I wish I could, but I can't. So we're stuck with them. So the question is, can you make them better? And the issue with webinars is, as you just alluded to, that the main overwhelming reason why we hate them is that you're getting no feedback. And you just don't know how it's going. And any human conversation, we are hardwired to be interested in how the other person is engaged or not engaged, how they're reacting. So we don't know that. It's speaking into a void. It's a terrible feeling. And it's not great, by the way, for the participants either, because they're not getting that sense of a conversation. Even if somebody else is doing most of the talking, if they're responding in various ways and you're making eye contact with them, then they feel included or can feel included in the conversation.
Right.
In a webinar, you don't feel included in the conversation. It's just a disembodied voice. So the first thing you have to do is say to yourself, okay, this is not the same thing as a lecture or a speech or one of the old-fashioned face-to-face means of communication. This is different, and we need to treat it differently. So the first thing you have to do is, first of all, cut it up into shorter bits. So you're probably running a 45-minute or an hour-long webinar because that's how long meetings go. All right, first thing to realize is the virtual world not as good, so let's make them shorter. So think of it doing it in 10-minute segments, because that's about as much as people can stand in the virtual world without any feedback at all on either side. And so at the end of every 10-minute segment, then use that opportunity to switch it up, do something different. And that can be as simple as asking for questions, but just make sure you get some.
Right.
And if nobody responds, if it's a smaller group, then go around the group and ask everybody.
Yeah, maybe polling techniques. A lot of the platforms have that capability.
Exactly. And you can ask simple questions like, how's everybody doing? Give me a red light, green light, or an amber light. And then you can find out their reactions that way. So it doesn't have to be hugely difficult or intrusive or require people to jump through hoops. But understand that there's lots of good research on webinars that show that if you tell them I'm going to ask you questions, they pay better attention.
Ah, okay.
And so it's just like the teacher saying at the beginning of the class, there'll be a test on this at the end of the day or the end of the week. We all pay attention suddenly, right? So it's a little brutal, but webinars are tough. So that's the first thing. Break it up into sections. And then at the end of each section, try to get some form of feedback. And then there are lots of other things we could say, but the other thing to do is to think about breaking up the delivery format. So don't make them all you talking into the void. Try to find other ways to do it. Have a round robin conversation. Do pre-recorded things. Do video if video is included, and so on and so forth. There are all kinds of ways to pep it up and to vary it. That's the key, is variation.
Vary it. Okay. Wonderful guidance. Fabulous. And there's so much more content in Can You Hear Me? How to deal with conference calls and texting and emailing and so forth. So absolutely a great one. I'll make certain to include the links to your books via the show notes here. So just a kind of follow-on final question. Where can people find you, and why should they seek you out?
So they can find us at publicwords.com, and they should seek us out because for no other reason, I've been blogging now since 2007.
Wow.
Yeah, it seems like a long time now. And I blog twice a week, except now in the summer, I throttle it back to once a week. So there's a huge trove of free information. A lot of the tips and tricks we've been talking about are there archived on the website. And all you have to do is go to the blog, type in your search question, any question about body language, and you'll probably get half a dozen posts that talk about it one way or the other. So lots of free information. Of course, we'd love to work with you, but if it's free information you're after, we got that too.
All right, outstanding. And so I have to ask a question. I know in the 2016 election cycle, you were a regular on Anderson Cooper during the debates. Any chance we're going to be seeing you? I know you've been writing about them in the early stages of the debates, the first round. Any chance we'll be seeing you there again?
Yeah, absolutely. As soon as the ante gets upped a little bit, as soon as we get into
below 30 or 40 candidates on a single debate.
Yeah, I have to say that that format is really tough. I feel bad for the candidates, but it's also tough on the audience. You don't get enough of any single one really to get a sense of them. And those kind of moments, as I alluded to earlier, like where Kamala Harris takes down Joe Biden, I mean, they're revealing in one sense, but they're also not revealing. She was gunning for him. She'd planned it out in advance. He wasn't ready. What does that really tell us? Does it really tell us how good a president either one of them would be? Right. Probably not, you know.
So, but it does have a powerful effect on the polls and people's thinking.
Exactly. She started moving up in the polls. He started moving down. So it's important. But it's just not, it's hard to imagine that that's the best possible way we can have to get to know our candidates. Nonetheless, it's what we're stuck with.
So, Nick, it's always a pleasure and an honor to have you here. Thanks so much for generously sharing your ideas, your insight, your wisdom, and your personal anecdotes with us. And thank you. Can't wait to catch up soon.
Thanks, Art. It's a real pleasure to chat with you.
You got it.